Hey listeners, how is it going? Can you believe it? Another month has passed and we are in the middle of September. September. I know I say this a lot whenever we approach a new month. And you must be thinking she's going to go on a rant about new months and what it entails. But it never fails to surprise me how unprepared I am each time. Things are moving at warp speed and I guess there isn't much to do but just go along for the ride, right? Although I must confess, what made me do a double take this time was the fact that we've lived with COVID and quarantined for half a year, 6 months. Now March seems like just yesterday. I know. March was also the longest month ever because we were sitting in anticipation of some miracle to happen. It didn't quite happen though, did it? Because of poor leadership and poor judgment, this country is still experiencing unchecked COVID infection rates and death rates. That is a truth we must all reckon with. European nations have banned us from visiting them.
We want to get the latest on that breaking news right now. The European Union has just released the list of countries that are allowed to travel into the EU. The United States is not one of them.
The EU, a bloc of 27 nations, is trying to recoup some of the summer travel season. So they want to make it for people, make it easier for people to travel within Europe and for select countries from the outside to come to Europe for non-essential travel, that is tourism, business, etc. And they were looking at how different countries from outside the bloc were doing with the COVID crisis, how they were managing it at home. And the U.S. was not on the list.
Let that sink in. And believe you me, all of us want COVID to end. But just because I want COVID to be over and you want COVID to be over, it does not mean it is. What scares me, though, is that we've become immune to not the virus, but to the concept of the virus. We've started to ignore how dangerous it is, how it discriminates against more vulnerable population, and how it is still with us. This is all to say we need to stay alert, take care of ourselves and our communities, and know that this will pass, but not without sacrifice. What we do day to day, as well as for the long term, makes a huge difference and is extremely crucial. When I talk about long-term, though, I am speaking to who we vote into office, who we decide should govern our country's COVID recovery and the movements that we either let wither or continue to push forth. So much is at stake, and believe me, it's overwhelming. But our today's guest, I'm hoping, can inspire us to stay active and fight in spite of all the failures and negativity. Paula Mendoza knows what it is like to feel exhausted and disillusioned. As if this country is not for her, but against her. But she also knows resilience like it's her middle name. She's a critically acclaimed filmmaker, author, a human rights activist who carries her Colombian heritage and immigrant identity with pride and perspective.
We have the power to change culture, right? And so Trump has the power to try and implement policy, racist policy. And it is, you know, by design, the Senate and the House has to approve that policy unless it's executive orders, and that's why there's all these lawsuits, la-da-da-da-da-da-da. That is all real and true. But what the people have the power to do is obviously vote in and out politicians, which is extremely important. But beyond that, we also have the power to create culture. We can create a culture of acceptance and love and welcoming outside of what the political sphere is talking about.
I am going to leave it to Paola to share more about herself, her work and passions, since I could go on forever about her accomplishments. So let's not waste any more time here and jump in. So let's go back a few years to November 2016. I call it the dreadful year, by the way. You were at the Javits Center, right?
Yes, I was.
And you were hoping to witness this historic event of Hillary Clinton being the first woman president. And we all know what happened. I was actually watching one of your lectures where you talk about all different emotions that you were feeling at the time. And I remember I felt this deep shame above all. But I also felt silly and naive. And the reason why I felt that was in that moment, somehow America had become a stranger nation for me. As a Muslim American, I felt like a place that I had called home for almost a decade and change alienated me with no regard for how their choice would impact me. Paola, did you feel that?
Well, I would say that, to be quite frank, I never really felt like I belonged in this country. I didn't feel like I was fully accepted or a part of this country. As an immigrant, as a immigrant from Latin America, as a brown woman, a woman of color, I have felt that I have always had to fight for my place in this country. And it was never given to me. So Trump's election didn't make me feel alienated. It actually, it was devastating because the hate, the white supremacy, the racism was so blatantly accepted by so many people in this country. I was not surprised by the racism, but I was surprised by how many people actually felt that way.
Yeah, that's such an interesting perspective. Can you talk a little bit about what was going through your mind as the election results were announced?
I think it was what was going through a lot of our minds. It was disbelief. It was pain. It was anger. It was a lot of fear. I work with immigrants and within the immigrant rights community, and specifically the undocumented community. So Trump made it very clear that he was going to attack my community. So I was very fearful for those in my extended network of friends, colleagues, coworkers, people I've been organizing with and telling stories for years, what this meant for them, because they were going to be attacked. And he has done exactly that. In the 4 years that he's been in office, he has attacked indiscriminately immigrants, undocumented immigrants, and documented immigrants. It has been the basis of his administration in many ways.
That is so true. And what I've realized is that in these 4 years, even immigrants, they feel that the word itself carries so much taboo and so much burden in a way. I have friends who don't want to be called immigrants anymore, which sometimes surprises me, because to me, I would rather reclaim the word and the identity than just brush it aside and not own it.
So what I would say is that, you know, I am a proud immigrant. I use that word with pride, with love, with gratitude, but I could understand why people might shy away from that term. That term now brings with it the possibility of retribution.
So Paola, how do we move forward? How do we reclaim our identity given all that's happened, given all that's happening? And I do understand that the kind of damage that's done, some of it may not even be reversible. But where do we go from here?
We have the power to change culture, right? And so Trump has the power to try and implement policy, racist policy. And it is, you know, by design, the Senate and the House has to approve that policy unless it's executive orders. And that's why there's all these lawsuits, la-da-da-da-da-da-da. That is all real and true. But what the people have the power to do is obviously vote in and out politicians, which is extremely important. But beyond that, we also have the power to create culture. We can create a culture of acceptance and love and welcoming outside of what the political sphere is talking about and what the politicals are pushing. Now, this is obviously very difficult to do, but it is absolutely possible. Because when we shift culture, when we collectively decide that immigrants are not only welcome here, but they are an essential part of our culture, they make the United States what it actually is. They are the fabric, the foundation of the United States. When we truly are able to believe that, then it doesn't matter if Donald Trump and or XYZ president is trying to, not that it doesn't matter, it doesn't change our heart when he's trying to implement some racist law, right? So I think that that's really, really important.
So let's talk about that. I feel like you're doing that through art because your work is at the intersection of art and human rights, which I really admire because I am a human rights activist and I can totally relate to it. And obviously post 2016 elections, I became content creator as well, which I never thought I would be doing. Let's talk about how art has helped you on individual level and also with community engagement to change the culture that you're talking about.
Well, you know, I use my art to tell the stories of immigrants, and I use my art to create the world that I want. I use my art to fight against the world that is presented and really use my art to imagine the world that I want and what others can strive for. I think that's the power of the artist. We create worlds that are unimaginable. We hopefully inspire people to love when the easiest thing to do is to hate. We fight back, or we can. We can choose to fight back with our art against hateful stories and really tell stories that are empowering and full of dignity and love. And so for me, when I decided to be an artist, I knew that from the communities that I came from, I couldn't just create art for art's sake, as they say. I really needed to use my art to shine a light on my community and shine a light on the women that raised me within my community. And what I've seen personally is that those women are often forgotten about. Those are the women that we walk down the street and we don't think are very important to our society. But what this pandemic has proven, it is actually those women and men that we now call essential workers. That in the moment of, you know, in our lifetimes, when society felt like it was on the brink of collapse and felt like we weren't sure how we were going to quite literally survive the next day, it was immigrant workers, essential workers, that allowed this country to keep functioning. They literally kept food on our tables. They allowed gas to continue to run through this country in trucks. And they were nurses and they were doctors and they were the backbone in the emergency. And I hope that when we come out of this pandemic, that we are indebted to these essential workers, to these immigrant workers, many of which are undocumented. And we can't just take their labor and not celebrate them.
So Paola, talking about art, and as you said, you've used art as a way or means to heal and reform, which is great. But art has perpetuated stereotypes, right? And exclusionary practices. We've seen that in the past. As a Muslim woman of color, I've seen that Muslim tropes, how Muslims have been stereotyped into either terrorists or facilitators somehow, but never protagonists. What do you think of this, and how have you challenged those norms within the art world? Because art bears a lot of responsibility for what has happened. Like, I understand Trump came in the office and things got a lot worse, but Trump wasn't the beginning of sexism or racism in America.
No, he was not, obviously. He is a product of that sexism and racism in America. I think that first and foremost, the way that we fight against stereotypes across all boards in the art field, whether it's film, music, television, visual art, photography, all of it, writing, is that we have artists that are full representations of their communities in positions of power, right? Mm. So we need, representation matters, not only on a visual standpoint, but on a creative standpoint, on a creation standpoint. If I am telling stories of immigrants as an immigrant, I have a very different perspective and a truer, authentic perspective,
right,
than someone from the outside. Now, I'm not advocating that you can only tell the stories that are of your community. I would never advocate that. But what I would advocate for strongly is that we need to have representation across the board with regards to creatives and creators. And if you are telling stories outside of your own physical communities, that there's a big responsibility in order to tell those stories. And those artists, and I've done that numerous times, I've told stories that are not from my community. We have to do that with respect and humbleness and awareness that there is a responsibility to tell these stories in truthful ways.
Do you think the art world has changed? Has there been a shift since Trump took office? Has there been more introspection?
When you say the art world, are you talking about the visual art world? Because I'm not a visual artist. So I kind of like use the art as an all-encompassing. But I would say that, so just taking it, talking about all aspects of art, I would say that since Trump took office, I think that there's definitely been changes. I think that they've been maybe cosmetic changes. I think, you know, because what I'm talking about is a systemic change, and systemic change takes time to undo the centuries of racism and sexism that we've endured. So I think there are definitely improvements for sure. We still have a long way to go. Absolutely. And we just need to keep on pushing. And what's really important is that we need to keep on pushing even after Trump is out of office, because getting Trump out of office is not the solution.
Right.
Anything. It is something that needs to happen right now. And then we need to do the work after he's out of office.
So, Paola, you've mentioned that you are an immigrant and you moved here at a very young age. Tell me about why your family immigrated to the U.S., where you settled, and what was it like growing up and being raised by a single mom?
You know, my mom left Colombia she had two kids, a three-year-old and a seven-year-old. And as she recounts, her marriage was not doing well. So she was coming to the United States for a new opportunity, a new horizon for her relationship. She thought that being in a different country would help them. It did not. And my mom ended up raising my brother and myself by ourselves. And my father was nowhere to be found in our childhoods. And so that really influenced, obviously, the trajectory of my entire life, and really influenced the stories and how the kinds of stories that I want to tell. You know, in my book, in my latest book, Sanctuary, it is a story of a 16-year-old undocumented girl who is living in a dystopian, futuristic United States in 2032. And unfortunately, in the book, 2032 is a really bad, terrible place to be, particularly if you are an immigrant. And at the heart of the story, ultimately, is a love story between a mother and a daughter, and what both will do to care for the other. And those are the stories that I, as an artist, continue to tell, are those love stories between mothers and daughters.
Talking about your book, Sanctuary, despite it being categorized as young adult, to me, the subject matter is far-reaching, right? And can teach us all a lesson or two. It's going to release on September 1st. Our interview will release after that. So by the time this interview releases, the book would have already released. Paola, can you explain the premise in more detail and what went into this particular project, and how is it different from your fiction called The Ones Who Don't Say? What are some of the differences in writing young adult versus other subject matter?
So you are correct that it is categorized as young adult, but I really wanted this book to be an intergenerational book. By that, I mean that I wanted young people to be able to read the book, but the themes within the book are very authentic, very real, and very adult in many respects, which is what happens with undocumented youth all the time. They are forced to grow up very early. So the themes in the book are very adult, and I feel that in its best moments, it will be shared and read intergenerationally. So young people and the adult in their life can have really authentic and deep conversations around so many of the issues that are brought up in the book. I've had young people read the book, and they tell me that they're very grateful that it's not condescending to them, that the issues are speaking to them in a way that they can handle it. And I've also had adults read the book that are astounded and shocked, and sometimes that this is a book for young adults. So I think that that conversation is really important. The difference between, obviously, The Ones Who Don't Stay, my first novel, and Sanctuary, the process was really different in that I had a co-writer for Sanctuary, which was a blessing. Abby Scher is the co-writer. It was wonderful to be able to work with Abby. Writing a book is a very tedious and slow and lonely, solitary process. So to be able to do that with Abby, made it go much faster, the process in and of itself. And B, it was amazing to have a partner. And I, as an artist, love to collaborate. It is one of my favorite things to do. And so across the board, in various ways in which I've worked, I'm always collaborating with someone. because it is just how I prefer to work. I feel it makes me a better artist when I collaborate.
Why young adult novel though?
Young adult novel, because the world currently that we're in is not a good place. It's really dark. It's really scary. And I think that the answer moving forward out of this world is young people. I feel that it is young people that can see a world that they haven't been hindered or hampered by our history. And I feel that Valley, she's 16, and in Valley, I find the answer to move us out of this darkness. And I think that that is just my general feeling with young people across the board. When we get Trump out of office, there will be a lot of healing that will need to happen in this country. And I think young people can lead the way in that healing.
Do you think, Paola, this movement should also be intergenerational? And the reason why I say that, because I see a lot of idealism, unadulterated idealism among young people. But as they move into their 30s and 40s and 50s, that idealism doesn't sustain itself. And to me, the reason why that happens is how so much of what should be taught to kids, to adults, is not taught, whether we talk about slavery era family separation, or we talk about imperialism, or we talk about US foreign policy. Do you think that in addition to young people, other age groups have a responsibility as well to learn and understand and be part of this fundamental ideological shift that we desperately need right now?
Yes, absolutely. Of course. I didn't mean to imply that it was only young people that would be doing the work. I think we all have a very important role to play in changing the world. It can't just be changed by one group of people. That would be unfair and unwise. But I think what I mean by young people at the center and leading us forward is that I don't see young people as too idealistic. I actually see young people as fearless. And I do think that the changes that we're going to need to make in this world from a climate perspective, from a political perspective, are going to need to be fearless leaders in the way that they're going to have to think in bold, innovative ways. We're going to have solutions to things that previously we've been unable to resolve. And I think the young people do that. We've seen that, you know, we've seen that with the activists from March for Our Lives. We've seen that with Greta. We've seen just young people being fearless and being bold. And so that's why I think that absolutely there is importance of intergenerational learning and learning from our elders for sure. But there's something very important about new, fresh, fearless ideas.
Yeah. And to be honest, I am all for idealism. I admire idealism in people. As a progressive, I have been so enamored by Bernie Sanders' idealism, who, by the way, is not obviously young. He's 78. But what I'm trying to say is that's what I like. I think we need fearless leadership. We need that kind of idealism where we think that unthinkable can happen, right? Unimaginable can really happen, and move away from practical ideas and practical steps, because that's what a lot of politicians have been feeding us over the years.
Yes.
So talking about young people, let's talk about DACA, because you've worked a lot with undocumented immigrants as well. And there was so much writing on DACA decision. And thankfully, Supreme Court ruled in favor of the program, at least for the time being, right? Where do you see this movement for immigration reform and immigration rights heading? And how are people mobilizing around this cause since the decision?
I would say that where we are heading is our first priority is to get Trump out of office. Then when Biden is in office, it is very well-known fact that Biden and Obama, for that matter, and Biden as his VP, were not great on immigration. They were actually pretty bad. They did some important legislation. Obviously, DACA is because of Barack Obama. He tried to pass the DREAM Act. Also, that failed in the Senate. But Barack Obama also deported over 2 million people from the United States. And family detention was happening under Barack Obama. And so what that means, I say that all to say, is that obviously Trump is 1,000 times worse on immigration than Obama was. But what we will have to do is hold Biden accountable to reverse some of the horrific policies that Donald Trump has implemented, and also push him towards what it is that we do want. We want a pathway to citizenship for 11 million people that are currently undocumented in this country. We want
Absolutely.
DACA to be instituted as law. We want it expanded, and we want it to allow DACA recipients to also have a pathway to citizenship. We want asylum reinstituted into this country because it essentially has ended under Donald Trump. We want family detention to not exist within the United States. So there are many, many things that we want. We will have to hold him accountable. And the great thing is that we have Kamala as his VP, and Kamala has been, obviously being from California, has been an advocate for undocumented immigrants for many, many years. We do have a very strong ally and someone that understands the issue very well in the White House when they win.
That's true. That's the hope. And thank you for saying that, because not many people recognize what was happening under Obama administration. Paula, I can hear some sweet chatter in the background. I believe it's your son. So let's pivot a little and talk about him.
My son, as you hear him in the background, is 7 years old.
And you've mentioned him often in your interviews, and you've talked about how you're raising him to be a feminist like you, a fierce feminist. What are the things you do, Paula, to foster such consciousness in him?
There's lots of things, big and small, that we do. One is the books that we expose him to are an array of girls, boys, non-gender characters, every race and ethnicity that we're able to find. We have very honest conversations with him about what's going on in the world. Obviously, his father and I are very politically active, so the conversations in the House are often about politics, and we don't shy away from them. So as an example, when family separation was happening, because I was so involved in family separation, he was often there when I was having these conversations, and he was asking me what is happening. Obviously, I was telling him in a way that a five-year-old could process it, but it was really important for him, for me, that he understood what I was doing. You know, the most important value that I can instill in my son is for him to be a compassionate person, a compassionate boy that will then hopefully grow up to be a compassionate man. And I think what we are lacking in this country on so many levels is true compassion, compassion that is powerful. And so that's what we and I are instilling in him. And with that comes obviously feminism. I think feminism is a natural extension of that. And very clearly he sees his mother as someone that's working, someone that's speaks her mind, is bold, is strong, is however he sees me, and someone that firmly is always reminding him that girls can do anything boys can do, right? Mm-hmm. And I was really excited when he came home from school one day, and he told me his little friends were talking, and someone had said something mean about a girl, that she can't do that. And he came home and he told me, and he said he didn't like that. And then he said, you know, he's like, Mama, I just don't understand because why he would say that about that girl, because his mama is a girl and he loves his mama. Aww. And to me, that was the correct analysis for a five-year-old boy to equate it to, that his mother is a girl. And if you love your mother, then you must love all women, right? And so like, that's a constant reminder that I repeat to him often now.
That's true. That's absolutely true. Paula, normally I end by asking guests about their idea of America and what it means to them. But we are 2 months away from elections. So I'm sure the idea and concept of America will no doubt change in these 2 months. But I want to know, we started by talking about 2016 elections and what we were feeling. Do you sense there is a different energy in the air now? And are you hopeful for a different outcome?
Well, I will say that in 2016, I thought Hillary was going to win. So I was sidelined when she didn't win. So I'm not sure that I think obviously there is a different energy around 2016 and now, because I think we're all more aware of how racist this country is. And we are aware that we can lose. We are not, at least I am not 100% confident that we will win. I have faith that we will win, and I believe that we will win, but I also know that there is a real possibility that we will lose. Now, that being said, I think that the pandemic has laid bare a lot of truth in this country. It has shown the importance, as I mentioned earlier, of immigrants and essential workers. It has also structurally laid out very clearly, or not structurally, it has laid out very clearly the structural racism and inequalities that exist, which is why Latinos and Black population are disproportionately dying from COVID and disproportionately being infected by COVID. And so I think that it has also shown us how important our politicians are to the well-being of each individual. I don't think that we can ever say again, at least as we know it, that a Democrat and a Republican are essentially the same thing.
Yeah.
That falsehood can be thrown out the window. And I also think that we will see, you know, we're in the middle, I know this will air later, but we're in the middle of the DNC. Tonight's the last night of the DNC. Biden is going to speak tonight. The vision that they have laid out for America is one that is inclusive. It is one that is diverse. It is one that talks about issues of that women are facing as central to the Democratic platform. It is one that includes Black Lives Matter and undocumented immigrants and trans lives. And that to me is exciting. It is a vision in the United States that I can get behind. I am curious to see next week the RNC. I'm curious to see what their representation looks like, how they see the America they want for all Americans, right? And obviously they don't. They see the America that they want for one part of the United States, which is mostly white men and women, if they fall in line with their white men. So I think the contrasting images between the RNC and the DNC will lay out very clearly what the future holds for this country.
But do you think what RNC presents, or what kind of representation they are talking about, it even matters? Because their voter base doesn't care. So even if they are not diverse, in fact, if they are not diverse, that's what they cash in on.
Oh yeah, that's what I'm saying. I don't expect them to have, but it goes beyond diversity. I don't expect them to be diverse. I don't expect them to be female friendly. I think they're going to play to their white base, their white male base. And I think the two conventions would be a contrast of what the future vision of this country should be, what the future vision of America should be. What America do you want to live in? It will be very, very blatantly white supremacist RNC. I have no doubt about that. And I want to believe that the majority of this country wants the vision of America that the DNC put forth in all of its complications and its messiness, but I think it's closer to the vision that I want. I know it's closer to the vision that I want than what the RNC is going to put forth.
That's true. And to be honest, as a progressive, I feel like I am obligated to vote for Dems. I am not motivated. I am not definitely as motivated as you are. I don't align with centrist policies of the Democratic Party for a very simple reason, that I feel like Muslims in America have been sidelined for the last 20 years. And the only reason we are even considered as a constituency is during the election or just before the election. And there are so many bigoted Islamophobic policies that were enacted starting in 2001. I completely align with progressive values because I feel like progressives see us as individuals and not as allies in war on terror. That's how Hillary Clinton defined Muslim constituents in 2016. But having said that, I don't feel I have an option, unfortunately. And I'm hoping that if Democrats win, we can hold them accountable. We can move past identity politics and talk about policy, and we can have robust policy debates around a number of issues, from U.S. foreign policy, U.S. diplomacy, to military expansion, because that's what scares me with Biden. He comes from an era very much focused on military expansion and imperialism, and that honestly has disproportionately impacted Muslim countries and countries in the Middle East and South Asia. But as you said, like, what do you do, right? What really bothers me sometimes is that I've seen people on social media shaming progressives for not being as enthusiastic, not realizing that some of the policies that were enacted are so personal and they've impacted us so poorly that sometimes it's difficult to show the kind of enthusiasm that some other people may show with this ticket.
No, I agree 1000%. And I'm not excited about Joe Biden. Let me just be
clear.
Like, my candidate was not Joe Biden. My candidate was Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
My candidate was Bernie. I'm not, Joe Biden doesn't excite me. Kamala Harris was a smart, good pick. She makes it much more exciting. There's obviously politics that I don't align with regards to Kamala.
Yeah.
But I agree with what you're saying. And I hear how difficult it is to be enthusiastic with regards to Biden, because it's personal. His policy that he implemented against you and yours is personal, just the way that Obama implemented policy against mine, that is personal. But I think that I do believe, and this is a great thing that Bernie did and then Warren did, he is more progressive than he was in 2008 and 2012, because the country is more progressive.
That's
so
true.
I think that we can continue to push him towards that vision that we want. And the DNC is more progressive. Like, the DNC was fucking, they embraced Black Lives Matter and trans lives and undocumented immigrants, and not the way that we wanted them to completely. And there was obviously, as you bring up, like, there was a Muslim aspect lacking in the DNC for sure. And the way that they treated Linda yesterday was complete. Linda Sarsour was completely a mistake, they being the DNC. But I will say that, like, that's the more progressive convention that I've seen that I can remember. And so, and that's because the country is moving in that way. And we just got to keep on pushing them in that way. And hopefully we'll be able to influence foreign policy as well. Because everything has been so domestic for the past 4 years, because we've been such a disaster.
Exactly.
That we haven't really been able to apply those progressive policies to our foreign policy. But I feel like we will be able to do that once he's in office.
Thank you, Paula. This was wonderful. I could go on and on about politics with you. And as I said, the kind of work that you're doing is so much in line with the kind of work that I am doing and I have done in the past. Before we wrap up, where can we find your book?
The book is at any bookstore, wherever books are sold, you can find it. It's Sanctuary. It comes out September 1st. It's my plea. I'm asking your listeners to please support art that is made by women and made by women of color, because if we want more of it, then those books, those movies, those TV shows have to do well.
And we have to move beyond Instagram posts. This is where we can make a difference, by buying your book. So please, listeners, buy Paula's book. And thank you so much for this great conversation.
Thank you. Take care of yourself and stay healthy.
So how was the interview? I hope you liked it. And if you did, follow Paula on her Instagram and do buy her book. It's important. That's how you support artists of color. And you can follow us on Instagram at @immigrantlypod and Twitter at @immigrantly_pod. Until next time, when we have another amazing guest. Take care.